man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Iffy Whitey Way, and I'm in the digital booth with my friends. So let me introduce you to them. First off, we have Alonzo Duralde. Alonzo, what's good?
Oh, I'll tell you, Iffy, you know, at this point, you take the small pleasures where they come. And, you know, as I've mentioned before, you know, Dave and I have really been, you know, eating at home all the time. He's really built up a pantry for us. He's been, you know, finding new interesting ways to make me eat better, which we've, I think, been doing. The Martha Stewart red bean veggie burger recipe is next level. Ooh. I have eaten my share of veggie burgers over the years. I'm not talking about your processed Morningstar Farms. I mean the ones that somebody makes in a kitchen. And they never stay together. They never, you know, they don't have that bind. They don't have that richness that you get like from an actual burger. But these, I'm telling you, they've got that consistency, that mouthfeel, all the things you want in a veggie burger. I mean, yes, it doesn't taste like beef. That's never going to happen unless you go with Beyond or Impossible or whatever. But for a veggie-based burger, Martha has nailed it. And Dave made them this week, and they were a real game changer for me.
Ooh. You're so lucky and spoiled. I will say, I always assumed if we'd hear the words mouthfeel on this show, it would be from Iffy. But it's been exciting getting it in this culinary form instead.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I'm a bigger fan of the veggie burgers that don't try and taste like burgers. Like, I like Beyond and Impossible Burger, but there's a place in San Francisco for all our Bay Area listeners called Super Duper, and their veggie burger is really good because it's like a nice crunchy, it's kind of like seedy in a way, and then it has like hummus on top of it. Solid. Good to go. That other voice you heard, though, is none other than Drea Clark. What's good?
Why, thank you for asking. So what's good for me is this past weekend, I hosted a murder club.
Ooh.
And which means over Zoom with six of my friends, we basically did a version of, you can buy these cold case file mysteries. And they're so nicely art directed. Like, it looks like a police case file, and it's your evidence log, your autopsy report, your suspect interviews. And you go through, and then there's like an envelope and different phases. So the first phase, you have to figure out, oh, who's exonerated and couldn't have been there. And then there's like, ours had a cell phone tower map and wreck phone call logs. And anyway, so it was so fun. And, you know, we're still obviously socially distancing as much as possible. Here in LA, it has been super hot again, and not all of us have yards or porches or whatever. So still finding fun ways to meet up with my friends over Zoom being my like worst and best thing of my days. But this was really fun. And so I took scan or pictures of everything. So everyone had all the evidence, and we went through it, got to solve a murder, and it took a couple hours, and it was great. And I feel
the
a little,
murderer is inside this Zoom.
Yes. Well, it wasn't one of us. It was a different version than your sort of dinner party where you get a character, which is maybe the next thing I'll try to squeeze into a Zoom. But
with costumes, I hope.
Oh, I mean, I wear a costume all the time anyway. What do you guys think? I'm just walking around in like leisure wear? Excuse me.
French maid all the way.
Ooh. Yeah, this flapper is not going to flap herself, you know? Iffy, what's good with you?
Oh, well, what is good with me is, I've been doing lots of things. I've been picking up a lot of things. One of them was the result of something cool I did. As you know, I stream on Twitch. I did a 24-hour stream on Monday, streaming from 10:30 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. the next day. Oof. It was an event, but I did it to raise money for the Bail Project. I was trying to raise $5,000, ended up raising $12,000 for the Bail Project.
Woo-hoo!
But in there, you know, we did a segment where I had one friend come over and he showed me how to make mead. So I'm making mead. So behind me in my kitchen is a mead, and I let chat vote on the spices that we put in the mead. So it's what is it? A cardamom, a cinnamon, vanilla bean, and hibiscus. And we're going to add peaches when I transfer the batch into the new, because you have to transfer the batch every week to the new container and let like the sediment of the yeast fall to the bottom. So
I just say, if you unlock Renfair Iffy, it's going to be whole new brand of admirers.
If you start LARPing and speaking Klingon, I just don't even know what we're going to do with all this.
I think I'm excited for you just expanding the demographic that's into you.
Add new things every, so I'm super excited, but I'm the most impatient person, so this is, I think, after, like, once it gets to the waiting period, that's when it gets real hard. Because I asked my buddy, and he seems like he's the same as me. He's like, oh man, just a few weeks. But then I'm looking on the mead boards and they're saying 8 months. Yeah, there's a whole mead community.
Oh god. And next you're gonna start making your own kimchi, and that's gonna test your patience.
Oh yeah. Oh wow. I know. Oh, I'm just going to hide one. I'm going to give one to my dad and be like, don't show this to me for 10 years, please.
No matter how hard I beg you for it, don't give it back to me.
Please. Oh, well, you know, speaking of times of old, E with an E after old, we're going to be discussing Enola Holmes. And we have a question from the Who Shot line. And of course, we have our staff picks. But first, it's time for our new segment, Itadic, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Each of us will read a news segment and answer the question, is this important? Do I care? And first up, director Barry Jenkins, who took home Best Picture and Best Adapted Screenplay for 2016's Moonlight, as well as a Best Adapted Screenplay nomination for 2018's If Beale Street Can Talk, has been set to helm the follow-up to The Lion King for Walt Disney Studios. The film will continue with the photorealistic technology that director Jon Favreau used in the 2019 version of The Lion King and 2016's The Jungle Book. It's been suggested that the story will further explore the mythology of the characters, including Mufasa's origin story. This is Jenkins' second film project at Disney, as he is also planning to direct a biopic of famed choreographer Alvin Ailey. Jenkins has also completed writing, directing a limited series adaptation of Colson Whitehead's Pulitzer Prize winning The Underground Railroad for Amazon, as well as a scripted drama based on the first American female Olympic boxing champ, Clarissa T-Rex Shields. Barry Jenkins is booked and busy. So Barry had this to say about the Disney follow-up: helping my sister raise two young boys during the 90s, I grew up with these characters. Having the opportunity to work on Disney, to work with Disney on expanding this magnificent tale of friendship, love, and legacy while furthering my work chronicling the lives and souls of folk within the African diaspora is a dream come true. There is no release date set for the Lion King follow-up or for the production to start. Is this important? Do you care?
I mean, do I want to see anything that Barry Jenkins makes? Yes. Do I begrudge him a big fat Disney check? No. However, .. Yep. Of all things, I mean, I'm sorry. Who loves that new Lion King? I don't know that anyone does. I mean, I guess it made money, and I guess that they want to sort of spring it onto new things. But I'd rather that he make a sequel to the Beyonce thing that was inspired by the Lion King.
Would watch. I think that, you know, looking at the other projects he has going both with Disney and elsewhere helps me in terms of my take on this, because we've seen a lot of independent directors rich with artistic vision and, you know, a unique perspective get sucked into a studio element where then all they're doing is navigating, hand-holding studio executives, and a lot of their talent is not necessarily utilized well. And the smaller, more intimate stories or unique stories they could be telling are lost to us. Barry Jenkins, as if he said is booked and
he likes jobs.
Yeah, and seems to be doing the, instead of, you know, they always do like one for them and one for me. He's like one for them, eight for me. And I do like that the other projects he's doing seem like the kind of projects I would want to see Barry Jenkins explore. Those all sound exciting to me. They're for different places. They have different scope to them. And I also, even it's dumb because I know exactly how press releases are made, but listening to him talk about specifically wanting to do a story within the African diaspora, not that there aren't many avenues to do that outside of the Lion King franchise, but I'm more on the, I do think this is important because I think following where artists go when they have a little success is key, but I care because I'm glad that he is going to be, you know, putting the Barry Jenkins magic in several baskets.
Yes,
I have half a metaphor there, but you guys get it. Yeah. You know how I love a basket. Yeah. Yeah.
Like the one that we're all going to hell in.
Where am I going and why am I in this basket? Yeah.
I have like both sides of feelings on this where I'm the same way where it's like, oh, I definitely wouldn't have thought or even guessed that there was going to be a sequel to that Lion King. But I am wondering if a original or a new take on a story is going to land a little bit harder, since I think one of the biggest disconnects was the uncanny valley of knowing that it's a close to shot for shot remake and then seeing these unemotional faces because they're so photorealistic.
It's that warthog you love, but now he's a warthog.
Yeah. So I'm curious to see what that looks like, but I also, you know, it is one of those things that is like, man, okay, I guess. But it's good to know that this also listed things that I'll be much more excited to check out by Barry Jenkins that I'll be chasing after. And some way, somehow, I'm sure I'm going to end up seeing this sequel.
Probably for this show. Who knows?
Yeah.
So, near perfect human Dolly Parton, the last thing that all Americans can still agree on is her awesomeness, will be starring in a Netflix holiday musical, Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square, directed by Debbie Allen and co-starring Christine Baranski and Jennifer Lewis. I like all those things. Parton will play a literal angel who changes the heart and mind of Baranski's greedy Regina, who plans to evict the townsfolk and sell her hometown to a mall developer. You might know Baranski from Sybil or The Good Wife or Mamma Mia. Drea will always remember her as the woman who hosted Saturday Night Live in 1996 with musical guest The Cure. Don't forget she was also in 9 1/2 Weeks. Jennifer Lewis, known to many from her role on Blackish, but beloved by those who watched Shangela impersonate her on RuPaul's Drag Race, plays Marjolaine, the owner of a beauty shop, who is a friend of sorts to Regina. Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square premieres on Netflix on November 22nd. Is this important? Do you care?
Woo! Raise all the flags!
Yeah.
Ring all the bells! I love this. I love that it's a musical, because if you're going to get Dolly Parton, she better have a guitar with her. And, you know, this the cast of it, the idea of a... that, you know, we've looked at Netflix. Netflix already had a good leg in terms of representation for queer people in their films. But there's also, this is a film where the three women in it are at least in their 60s, or and then some. I don't know how old Jennifer Lewis is. So a musical that stars a number of women of a mature age, and that's just it. Do you know what I mean? It's the same shape of all of these. It clearly has Christmas Carol sort of Ebenezer Scrooge vibes to it, which has never been done before. There's never been a Christmas show that followed the... I don't know if you knew that.
That's no one
ever does that.
Jennifer Lewis is 63. What is cool also is not just that they are all women of a certain age, but like, Baranski and Lewis are very talented and very funny. And because they are character actresses, they are very rarely the lead. So the idea of those two being like one and two on the call sheet is very thrilling.
So this week we found out a story from actress Sienna Miller speaking to Empire Magazine for a special commemorative issue they're doing dedicated to Chadwick Boseman following his untimely death last month. Sienna Miller was telling a story praising Boseman for personally addressing pay disparity on the thriller 21 Bridges, which was released last year. In addition to starring in the film, Chadwick Boseman was a producer and actively sought out Sienna Miller to play opposite him, saying he was a fan of her work. Per Sienna, quote, "Boseman offered me this film, and it was at a time when I really didn't want to work anymore. I'd been working nonstop, I was exhausted, but I really wanted to work with him. This was a pretty big budget film. I know that everybody understands about the pay disparity in Hollywood, but I asked for a number that the studio wouldn't get to. And because I was hesitant to go back to work and my daughter was starting school and it was an inconvenient time, I said, I'll do it if I'm compensated in the right way. Boseman ultimately donated some of his own salary to meet Miller's requested fee, saying, quote, you're getting paid what you deserve and what you're worth. Miller noted that Boseman's generosity and support was unprecedented in the industry. Quote, it was the most astounding thing I've ever experienced, she says. That kind of thing just doesn't happen. It's unfathomable to imagine another man in that town behaving that graciously or respectfully. Is this important? Do you care?
Oh, for sure. I suspect that it probably happens more than we think, and we just never hear about it until someone dies. It doesn't happen enough. And I think there are a lot of people who, you know, can command these salaries, generally men, who would be wise to, you know, spread that around to make sure that they're working with the best people possible and the ones that they know are of worth, even if the producers maybe haven't, you know, figured that out. I mean, I always remember one of the reasons that Richard Pryor made so many terrible movies back in the day was that his negotiating style of getting out of a movie he didn't want to do was to ask for more money. And then they would give it to him. And it was like, oh, damn, now I have to make this thing. And so I think at least if you're going to be in the position where like they are just heaping, you know, money at you and they're not going to like give you what you want for your co-star, then yeah, I think for the good of the project, if nothing else, and for your own future as a, you know, somebody who's making films, not that 21 Bridges is the, you know, example here, it's a smart move. Like it's generous, but it's also shrewd.
There are a couple of things I found really interesting in this, and one is if you have an actor who's a producer, the idea of worth when you're packaging a film is always hard because you're told as a producer of, this actor can get you this much financing or has this much international or whatever.
The algorithm. And there's,
you're literally assigning a value, a monetary value of worth to a person, which is the grossest feeling. And having Chadwick Boseman say, you're worth what you think you're worth is such a beautiful philosophical way. But I also found it interesting that in telling this story, Sienna Miller, it seemed such a typical like female response of, it's like she listed all these reasons why she had asked for this. And they weren't just because I'm an accomplished actress with the long history of film and deserve it. It was, oh, well, it's a really hard time for me. I was worried about my daughter. I had all of this. And I found that justification. That's the difference of what I've seen. I've had plenty of dudes just ask me for a lot. And then women who are like, oh, but so I need it because of blah, blah. Which
they
was
come with the
a
receipts.
Whole, yeah, a whole wrinkle of it.
I mean, it always really does. It's nice to hear, but it really does suck to hear how great someone is after they've passed, you know, just doing great. And once again, just like, you know, the battle he was fighting, not publicly boasting about it, especially when we see so many actors who they'll just simply boast about being like, make sure you give her a little more, pat me on the back variety, you know, like he's like,
especially
no,
after they've already been shamed into doing it publicly.
Exactly. But they're taking a victory lap. And here's this person doing it completely in silence just because he wants her in the film. Rest in peace to Chadwick Boseman. This is very important. I do care. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking about Enola Holmes just as soon as we hear from another one of the shows on Maximum Fun.
Hello there, ghouls and gals. It is I, April Wolf. I'm here to take you through the twisty, scary, heart-pounding world of genre cinema on the exhilarating program known as Switchblade Sisters. The concept is simple. I invite a female filmmaker on each week and we discuss their favorite genre film. Listen in closely to hear past guests like The Babadook director, Jennifer Kent, Winter's Bone director, Deborah Granick, and so many others every Thursday on MaximumFun.org. Tune in if you dare.
It's actually a very thought-provoking show that deeply explores the craft and philosophy behind the filmmaking process while also examining film through the lens of the female gaze. So, like, you should listen.
Switchblade Sisters.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Ify Wadiway. In the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Alonzo Duraldi.
Drea, would you mind providing us with a synopsis?
Yes, for our dear new friend, Enola Holmes. So, we have the more recognized story centered around the Holmes brothers. Older brother, Mycroft. Younger, brilliant deductive and cold detective, Sherlock Holmes. But what we don't know and what this world brings us is their much younger sister, Enola Holmes. So, Mycroft and Sherlock are grown men. They've moved out. And their sister is being raised by their mother, Eudoria, and in a unique fashion, especially for the time. They are very physically active. They're doing martial arts in the orchard. She's learning all sorts of things from botany to literature. But she's doing it all in a very enclosed setting. So Enola Holmes is a very bright girl with zero street smarts or world knowledge, which becomes problematic when she wakes up to discover that her mother is missing. And the brothers come back, are shocked at the way that they've been living. Mycroft wants to pack her up and send her to Fiona Shaw's School for Girls, which don't we all want to go there? Because oh, I do. Yeah.
Hard pass.
Yeah. And instead, Enola discovers the first sort of clue that her mother left her, and kind of following in the deductive reasoning path of her older brother, decides to head out and find her mother. On the way, she meets a young Marquess, a very, very beautiful young teenage boy who is running from home for his own reasons, and their stories sort of intertwine as Enola makes her way into the world, tries to stand on her own two feet, and does some fighting and sleuthing along the way.
Ooh, yes.
I like this a lot, and I have some qualms about a few things, but what I was mainly thinking was, I'm really looking forward to the next one. Because I feel like this one, you have to, like, you've got to do all this world building around this new character. There's maybe one case too many. I kind of felt like either we could do the mom or the Marquess, but both is a little, it felt like a lot. But, you know, I think I like the verve of it all. I think Millie Bobby Brown is a delight to watch. I will say, after about the third time she looks to the camera and addresses it, I went to IMDb, was like, who directed this thing? And of course, the guy who directed all but one of the episodes of Fleabag. And I'm like, well, of course she's talking to the camera. That's what this guy does.
That said, that is not an easy thing to pull off. And you're so right. Millie Bobby Brown is incredibly charming. She has a lot of movie on her back with this. And she has an energy and a magnetism that really keeps you on. And she is young. Like, this is, it's a hard thing to do, to pull that off, but to not have that sort of Disney, hey guys, my mom left me a clue, let's go figure it out. And instead, you know, there's sort of nice nuances there. She has there's also, she gets to just do so much ridiculous. She's gonna dress like a peasant boy, and then a veiled widow, and then another. Like, there's a nice, when I did, because I'd recently read this Lady Sherlock series, I did keep having to remind myself, like, oh, this is more of a family audience. It's a broader appeal. It's a younger audience. And that's not to say I don't think it's dumbed down. Like Alonzo said, it is deep with story. I'd love to hear what more of what you guys think of the world building, because that was something I liked There's so many characters in it. There's a woman who's like her mom's jujitsu teacher who has a tea shop in London. And then the Fiona Shaw super intense school mistress.
I love a secret society with their own like secret code language. That's always fun. Oh, and Fiona Shaw was a very hissable villain, as she always is.
Oh, she's so good.
Yeah. No, this was all great. I was catching everything it was putting down. This is definitely one of those series that like that TikTok age kid is just going to gobble up because, you're right. It doesn't talk down to him. Like, sure, it's not as like dark and twisted as like a adult detective story, but this is a detective story through and through. I really like the costume changes, but when I was watching it, it was definitely watching for like, oh, this is gonna be something that, you know, Naomi is gonna really dig when she gets a little older. Like, it's gonna feel, the best way I can describe it in this movie itself is when you're the age that I'm thinking of, that is the perfect target for this. This is that media that feels like you shouldn't really get to watch it, but you do, because it kind of like, it's walking that line of being just a little like, it's almost a little much. And if, you know, without ruining it, you know, at the end, we did get some action, I guess that's what I'll say, which I was surprised by. I was like, okay. So I like it.
It's Victorian action.
It's I'd say aspirational for like, you know, tweens who are looking forward to being in their late teens. You know, mm-hmm. if you're too young for Nancy Drew and too young for Kay Scarpetta, this is like that sweet spot in the middle.
Kay Scarpetta. I will say, so Henry Cavill, professional handsome man, was, you know, once again professionally handsome in this. He's just
far too dressed, I think.
Such a dreamboat. I honestly was looking at the screen thinking, you know, he would have better luck finding his sister if he just removed that top. And he kept not removing his top. But I will say, the unfairness done to the beautiful Sam Claflin. Here's the thing, Sam. You're going to share all your scenes with Henry. For some reason, you're going to be thinner than you normally are. Henry's going to be bigger. Also, we have this horrible hairstyle and the grossest mustache ever to put on your face.
Claflin is one of those guys, though, who knows how attractive he is and realizes that that's why he's not being taken more seriously as an actor. So if he can throw on specs and a mustache and like in their finest or whatever, he is first in line to frump it up.
I had to Google pictures of him as Finnick Adair from The Hunger Games to remind myself of just his beauty and be like, Sam, I know you got it. Don't worry. So we remember. The North remembers.
He will bring his own bushel to hide his light under.
That's true. He's an actor.
Oh, I also wanted to say I really, really did like Cavill as Sherlock. Like that, you know, it never once felt like, oh, this is Cavill being Sherlock. Like it felt like really light, even though I'm like, this Sherlock is throwing hands, this Sherlock is going into hand-to-hand combat, but then I want to see that. Like, I want to see this Sherlock throw down.
Which, to be fair, that's part of the whole mythology of Sherlock Holmes, is he is a pugilist. He is someone, and you know, the Guy Ritchie versions of Sherlock, not Hughes, but Holmes, leaned into that so much and did. Mm-hmm. And I liked those fight sequences in them, but it was so much about the physicality. So the irony of having a Superman-sized Henry Cavill there being like, oh, no, I'm definitely just going to sit here in my suit and talk.
Yeah.
Twist.
But you know, but it's hard to step into that role, I think, because it's been, there are so many iconic Sherlocks over the year, going all the way back to like Basil Rathbone.
Oh, Basil, you know,
people have really kind of put a stamp on this character, most recently Robert Downey, but I mean, like, you know,
and Benedict Cumberbatch,
I mean, you know, Christopher Plummer, you know, that TV show with Jude Law? Elementary. Who was on Elementary?
That's Johnny Lee Miller.
I always get those guys confused.
Good point. Yeah.
You know, so to figure out a way to be like, okay, I'm not that guy. He's younger. He's not as established. He's not as eccentric. You know. And look, I'm also old enough to have seen young Sherlock Holmes in the theater, and this outpaces that one by a mile.
Definitely. Yeah. There is a rich history of Sherlock's. There's also a nice, you know, we think we know what Sherlock Holmes has. Yeah. And especially with the Benedict Cumberbatch, which although it's set in modern day, seems to feel like it's the more real version of Sherlock. Like, oh, this is the intended curmudgeonly kind of prickish dude. And Henry Cavill does a really nice job of coming across as intelligent and deductive in all of the ways that you need him to be. But like, and he's not connected to his sister. There's this whole thing that the estate of Arthur Conan Doyle is literally suing Netflix because Henry Cavill's Sherlock shows different emotions in this. And they say that Sherlock only had different emotions in the books that are not in public domain. And therefore Netflix owes them for his emotions, which wow. is my favorite lawsuit ever.
That is man. So wild.
But I thought that he split that difference really well because he's not the heavily cold fish mannered Benedict Cumberbatch, but he doesn't get there and want to like protect his sister or dig deep, you know. It's a nice yeah. unraveling, and I'm sure to be further explored if they make more of these like they want to.
Now, so, I've only seen one or two of the Cumberbatch episodes. Are they explicitly portraying him as like sort of on the spectrum? Is that the idea there?
Oh, he's definitely on the spectrum. Yeah. And it even comes up later on. People mention it. They're fantastic. You should watch
them. I know. The ones I've seen, I've really enjoyed, but it's just, you know, too much media.
There's so much. Yeah, so much to watch.
Those are great. They're rare, too, because each is like feature film length, and there's 12 of them, but they have a progression, so they're sort of feature film episodics.
I did
much
cheat.
Like the Marvel universe.
There you go. I did cheat and watch the last one where they have where they all think they're in Victorian times or whatever, and they do it like a traditional Sherlock.
Oh, okay.
It was like a Christmas special one year. Or
it was. I was going to say that was a special. I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. That's what I was going to say is, and this is going to launch into a discussion about the movie as a whole and not just focus on Henry Cavill's thick neck, perfect jaw as Sherlock. But there, I like the idea of this like more warm Sherlock that eventually gets to the curmudgeon version, and I think there leaves room to it. As a matter of fact, I think in this movie there's a lot of breadcrumbs left, and that gets me excited, and I hope they do continue it, because one, I think it's phenomenal, and I think this is going to be one of those things that if people aren't hyped now, there's going to be one weekend where the TikTok kids check it out and it's just going to go out the stratosphere. I'm telling you now, wait for it. A popular TikTok kid is going to sit down and watch it and it's going to blow up. But like we never really fully know what the mom's like motives are with the secret society. So that's a sequel there. We know that Sherlock wants to take his sister under his wing, but they are, you know, estranged at this moment because she's off to do her own thing. So
she's
just
in the wind.
Yeah. There's so much just juice. And I think that's always like the perfect first movie, because Alonzo's right. You have to do all this setup that you don't really get to do the best story, but I think making the story compact so you can build it out, but leaving enough breadcrumbs so that we really want to see more is exactly how you kick off a first movie. So yeah, it gets me excited for more, which is a good time to start trying to figure out what would y'all rate this movie?
Well, I'm a screen it. Obviously in the parlance of our world, that's just the top vote. Yeah. I would have happily seen this in a movie theater. The other final thing I'll mention that I forgot is if you're looking for an escapist thing, this is it. Because even when Enola is in the wind and on the run, like she always just is a thick wad of cash. Do you know what I mean? You're never worried this girl who's out there is going to be harmed or is sleeping in doorways and like none of that. It is nice escapism, which is so much of what I'm looking for. And it's a screen it for me.
Yeah, I would say screen it. And in fact, I would venture to guess, I have a hunch that when the day finally comes through whatever Herculean tasks need to be required, that we all get to go into theaters again, that they will make this available at least as like a Fathom event or something, because even though it's out on Netflix and it's out in the world already, I think when people later have the option to see it in a theater, they'll want to see it in a theater because it really is gorgeous. But yeah, again, I hope there's sequels, and I think I'm glad we got a lot of this groundwork out of the way. But Ify's totally right. They've left themselves so many interesting paths to follow, and I hope they do.
You know me. You could hear it right now. This movie, I am also screening it. As a matter of fact, if I heard just for one off, they just for funsies, were going to do a screening, a COVID safe screening in San Diego, I would do that before watching Tenet. One, because they gave me the option to watch it on Netflix. And two, because I can already tell that I'm going to like this movie more than Tenet. So,
yes, unnecessary controversy.
Yeah, yeah, I know. I don't sit here and force people to watch movies during in a theater during a pandemic. Like, don't be that guy, because then I'm gonna have to roast your movie without even seeing it. Why? Because I'm not going to a theater to see your movie. I might love Tenet, but guess what? Until I see it, this movie's better. All right, we'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun. See you in a second.
Hi, I'm James, host of Minority Corner, which is a
podcast that's all about intersectionality. It's hosted by James with a guest host every week,
discussing all sorts of wonderful issues, nerdy and political,
pop culture,
black queer feminism,
race, sexuality,
news.
You're gonna learn your history, their self-empowerment, and it's told by what feels like your best friend.
Why should someone listen to Minority Corner?
Why not?
Oh my god, free stuff.
There's not free stuff.
The listeners of Minority Corner will enjoy some necessary LOLs, but mainly a look at what's happening in our world through a colorful lens.
People will get the perspective of marginalized communities.
I feel heard. I feel seen.
Like you said, you need to understand how to be more proactive in your community, and this is a great way to get started.
Join us every Friday on Max Fun or wherever you get your podcasts.
Minority Corner.
Because together, we're the majority.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Ify Wadiway, and in the studio with me are
Alonzo Duralde,
Drea Clark.
Now it's time to play a call from the Who Shot line, and our special guest producer, Hannah, will be making this happen. So, this time, I say, Hannah, play that call!
Hello, Ify, Drea, Alonzo, and lovely guest. This is Andrew in Montana. While the world literally and figuratively burns around us, I find it hard to motivate myself to watch films with a dark subject material. I'm no film buff, so my examples that come to mind are Schindler's List, more recent Spotlight, or any number of documentaries. As programmers and critics that may not have much choice on when you can watch something challenging or upsetting, how do you ramp yourself up to watch these films? Or then, how do you not fall into a deep, dark depression for the next week? Love the show. Thanks.
Ooh, that's a good question, Andrew.
Thanks to Andrew in Montana. This one's interesting because I feel like this is a question we could have gotten at any point because there are things, you know, for this show, we have to, quote unquote, watch things. Yeah. Or certainly all of us have elements of jobs where we have to watch things. I know Alonzo and I have a lot of that where you don't get any say in what you're watching, but it is a different time for that kind of feeling. And I know for my personal viewing, ever since March, I've been on a very, no, I can't. Is it super dark? Like, I've had a bunch of people literally recommend a TV show called Dark to me. And I'm like, yeah, Dark? No, I'm out. So it's a thing you deal with all the time. And I think it means even more these days, but yeah, I've navigated that for years. Alonzo, I feel like you're nodding at me.
No, I totally agree. I mean, you're right. When I'm a programmer, it's like I'm just working my way through a stack of things, and I have no idea really what they're gonna. I have a vague idea of the plot for each one, but I don't know how dark it's going to get, you know? And also, yeah, at a film festival, the same thing. I was just thinking about how there was one year where this was before this movie literally made me change the way that I cover Venice. I flew in, I got there, I arrived just in time to hit like a 10 o'clock screening, and it was That Netflix movie about child soldiers with Idris Elba.
Beast of No Nation.
Beast of No Nation. Yeah. And I was like, oh my God. And so now whenever I go, like, I make it a point to fly in the day before the festival starts so that I can get a good night's sleep and sort of like amp myself up for that kind of thing.
Yeah, you can't have jet lag and child soldier stories.
Yeah, that's just, that's de trop. But you know, yeah, I think in a lot of ways it is the very requirement of it that makes me do it. Cause I think a lot of times, yeah, like I'm with you, Dre, in terms of this year, if you're going to offer me something that I should watch for quote unquote entertainment, and I know it's going to be a drag, I'm like, nope, not watching it. But when it's your job, you just hunker down and do it, and then you write, you know, the programmer report you have to write about it, or you write the review you have to write about it, and then you just move on. And that's kind of the nature of the job anyway. Whether you see something great or terrible or sad or happy, you soak in it, you do the write up, and then you move on to the next thing. So I guess really a lot of times that's a good thing because it keeps me from having to sort of dwell in the house of the gloom of this movie. I just, you know, like, nope, it's flush. I'm off to the next thing.
I do think it's important to feel fine setting boundaries for yourself if you're able to, because I know there's also, you know, we're people that, like, we get to award season and kind of starting this sort of, well, who knows what it'll be since they pushed everything, but that, you know, all the good stuff comes out, and a lot of the good stuff is bummer stuff that you're talking about. And I think it's also that thing of balancing, wanting to see everything and being in the zeitgeist and knowing the talking points. But also, you know, this is a time of taking care of yourself in many ways, and art is meant to bring out emotions in you. And if you are not feeling, if you're already feeling plenty of those, don't feel bad about skipping things. For me, I'm also of the, there's literally hundreds of films I watch a year that I don't have a choice in seeing. And many of them are emotionally draining in ways. I am a notoriously bad watcher of documentaries in the sense that every single one of them makes me cry. If they're poorly made and have a heartbreaking subject, I cry. If they're well made and have a subject that's like a good person but has a moment of grace, I cry. So, you know, there's things that are draining. The big thing is, and maybe it's helped by seeing so many things or seeing them for work, it's different than when you're taking on viewing because it's fun and just like, this is what I'm doing in my downtime versus part of my job. Then you're sort of letting it melt into you more. Whereas if it's, oh, this is part of my job, I'm a daytime watcher of things that I'm obligated to see, it's sort of easier. But there's certainly, there are films that stick with me in ways that I have to consciously, as Andrew from Montana phrased, like, how do you avoid the deep, dark depression of a film that may be a real heavy hitter? And I think I like reflecting on a film in a manner that's respectful of the subject matter and matter and giving that moment to the art of it and appreciating what it brought out of me. And then I put it in a very small little pink box, like the ones they make in
Grand Budapest Hotel.
Wes Anderson, the Grand Budapest Hotel. You knew exactly what I was thinking. I put those feelings for that movie in a little pink Grand Budapest pastry box. And then I put it on a shelf and go on with my day and probably watch the next thing that's going to bum me out. But I do think it's fair enough. Like, you navigating your own emotions is one thing. Navigating emotions that have been thrust on you by a work of art, man, you don't have to carry that. Put them in a box.
I'll tell you, I've been watching these new Steve McQueen movies for The Wrap that are premiering at the New York Film Festival. And these are the upbeat, fun Steve McQueen movies. Like, I mean, they're about issues, but like, they're not as, it's not like the grind of watching Hunger or Shame or 12 Years a Slave, but it's the happiest parts that make me burst into tears because they so effectively communicate this sort of communal joy. And oh, look, we're all in a room together dancing, or we're all out in the street together dancing, we're listening to music, and we're breathing droplets on each other. And it's just like, it destroys me because he captures it so well that a thing that I don't even, that I don't spend my day thinking about how I miss it is just brought right to me through the power of his filmmaking. And it's devastating. So you never know.
Iffy, how do you move on emotionally from films that knock you on your butt?
So, you know, I'm one of those like dorky folks who likes to sit in their emotions.
What?
So, yeah, yeah.
Oh, sorry. I thought that was your full statement.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I like sitting in it and kind of trying to like really tap into like why I'm feeling that way. But I think the number one thing before anything is like, yes, feel free to skip. You have to. Don't. I'm the biggest proponent of, if you know yourself more than anyone else, and if you know you'll respond in a way that is negative to yourself, get up out of there. Don't force it just because so many people are good. But if you're in a position or you're blindsided, something I like to do is just, I know like the things that crack me up online. Like I have certain accounts, pages, and I just kind of watch those and just offset it. Kind of the same way if you see a scary movie, you try and watch something happy after. I do the same thing. Like just try and watch as much things that can bring me joy, that make me smile and laugh, and then hopefully that offsets everything.
Yeah, I'll add to that. If you watch the emotional things in daylight, that's great.
Yes.
And you look out the sun, it's a whole different vibe than if you watch it at night.
Right before bedtime.
No, don't do the heavy hitters then. Everyone wants to, but do it during daylight. And then, yeah, I'll follow up things with Letterkenny if I need to. So I feel you on that.
Okay, Drea, okay. Okay, Drea.
Pitter patter.
Thank you so much, Andrew. That was a great question and a great discussion. And thank you to everyone who's called in. Please continue to do so. And as a reminder, the number for the Who Shot line is WSY-803-1664. And now it is time for our staff picks. It could be any movie at all. Alonzo, why don't you start?
Sure. Well, I'm going to keep beating that drum for physical media. And this week, the Criterion Collection has put out a box set called Martin Scorsese's World Cinema Project Number 3. This is, as the name implies, an ongoing series where not just one of the world's great filmmakers, but one of the world's great cineasts is bringing up films from around the world from the past that should be considered canonical and maybe just haven't been seen by a lot of people, even who, you know, make an effort to have a rich film background. So he has picked 6 films, as old as 1934 and as recent as 1980. And they're from all over the place, Brazil and Indonesia, Mauritania, Iran, Mexico, Cuba. I'll tell you, 6 titles in here. I'd only ever heard of one of them. The movie Pichot from Hector Bubenko, just because I remember Siskel and Ebert always talking about it back in the day. But all these other ones, totally new to me. Filmmakers that I have, for the most part, also never heard of. So, like, these are not your obvious choices of international classics. He's got a really good eye for this stuff, and he really cares about film preservation and just sort of getting these movies out in front of people. And so I love that he and Criterion, I'm sure these are probably all streaming on Criterion Channel as well, but these are great sort of, you know, if you're the kind of person who has a shelf of DVDs that people will come over and judge you by when they come to your house in the day that they can come to your house again, this is the kind of thing you'll want to have on it.
Okay, so I have 2 because I'm that person. Okay. They're both on Netflix, which apparently I'm that person. One of this I've mentioned before, so I'll just very quickly talk about it. It was one of my favorites at Sundance this year. It's a documentary called Dick Johnson is Dead by director Kirsten Johnson. Some of you may know her from her previous film Camera Person. But Dick Johnson is Dead is a documentary she made with her father, Dick Johnson, when he was ailing, and it is a very, it's literal gallows humor. It is him reenacting what, like, he at one point is in a coffin and they do a fake funeral for him. He does a lot of things like pretending different ways where he could die. So it's them sort of confronting his mortality with humor and a lot of love, and what you get from their relationship and what you get from his ideas of life and the end of life and how to look at it are pretty incredible. And the other is a film that will also be on Netflix, and these are both coming out sort of the first week of October, called Vampires Versus the Bronx. It's by director Osmani Rodriguez, who does a lot of Saturday Night Live stuff. And I watched this for a different festival and found it so fun. It is very sort of, I'm loath to compare it to Attack the Block because it is a different tone entirely, but it does follow like this great group of like a very authentically multicultural group of kids in the Bronx who discover that there's vampires in the form, who are also like big developers moving in to like build out things. And freaking Meru from Desus and Meru plays the bodega guy who they hang out with all the time. And
Bodega Boys.
Yeah, it's fun and ridiculous and just happy. And he's a new talent to look out for. This is his first film. So those are my two that are just supposed to be one.
Well, my, as I like to do, bouncing off someone we saw in the film and, doing something else they've done great. And it's none other than my goth bae, Helena Bonham Carter. no one celebrated the split from Tim Burton more than I did. And then celebrated even further when I learned she was dating Young. So,
I also like this for you.
Setting intentions, going once Hollywood starts having its parties again, going out there, getting out there. But I will say she was great in The King's Speech, which is one of my earlier like smarter, quote unquote, smarter movies where I stepped out. And it's because I saw it in the airplane. I was like, oh, these movies kind of good.
I want to bottle the look that Alonzo just gave you and wear it as a scent when I need to feel superior to people. Because that was amazing.
Don't be sleeping on King's Speech.
Oh, wow.
I was sleeping during King's Speech.
That was heat, a man overcoming his own voice, fighting with yourselves. All right. Alonzo and Drea, thank you so much for being here. Drea, I'm very grateful you reminded me that Christine Baranski hosted Saturday Night Live in 1996 with musical guest The Cure, and that Shangela impersonated Jennifer Lewis on RuPaul's Drag Race.
So welcome. It's weird. It's almost like I wrote that into the script myself for you to thank me for those two very specific pop culture moments. That means a lot. Thank you, Iffy.
I feel like there are a lot of people in the SHOT fam who did get hyped for those reminders. So
For sure.
Thank you.
And if again, please just think of the Saturday Night Live stage and then think of Christine Baranski next to The Cure on it.
Ladies and gentlemen.
The Cure. It makes me so happy. Okay. Ooh. Okay, I'm done.
Okay. If you'd like to support the show, please visit MaximumFun.org/join. And again, the number for the Who Shot Line is WSY8031664. And if you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at Who Shot Your Pod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/WhoShotYourPodcast, or send us an email at WhoShotYou@MaximumFun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production from Maximum Fun. And before I go, a big thank you to Hannah for stepping in
when
Casey turned his back on us.
Oh, Casey and his stupid cross-country drive.
I know. Boo. We'll see y'all next week.
Jack Kerouac.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.